Hebrews 1:1 to 2:8, The Son of God. The 17th talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits was presented by Ron Julian on February 17, 1998, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
It is my hope that the topic tonight is the beginning of the book of Hebrews, because that's what I'm going to talk about. I can remember when I was a young Christian and starting to read the Bible and study the Bible and think about the Bible, I can remember sort of getting the vibe from the other Christians that I knew at the time that the book of Hebrews was a really hard book, and sort of almost discouraging me from reading it. It was like, this is the kind of book that only experienced, really smart Bible students ought to look at because it's really hard. My impression of it was, it was a book filled with complicated theological arguments concerning comparing the Old Testament priesthood and the Levitical system and the sacrificial system and comparing that with the priesthood of Christ, which seemed pretty esoteric and definitely didn't seem to be speaking to my immediate needs at the moment. It seemed like what is called in theology a Christological book. That is, it was filled with theology about the Christ, the person of Christ, the role of Christ. And that is true as far as it goes. The book of Hebrews is filled with teaching about the person of Christ, the role of Christ, what he did, what it means that Jesus was the Christ. But as I have looked at the book and had a chance to think some more about it, I think I've come to see that Hebrews is a lot more than that. Above everything else, the book of Hebrews really is an evangelistic book, I think. The author of Hebrews is speaking to people who are on the verge of making the biggest mistake of their lives, which would be to walk away from Jesus as the Christ. They are Jewish believers who are on the verge of deciding that Jesus is not the Messiah after all. He's not the Christ after all. And they would be better off to just return to the Judaism of their youth and forget all this Christianity nonsense. That's the group of people to whom this letter is being written, and all of the discussion about who Jesus is and what his function is as the Messiah, all of that is meant to be an argument to convince them not to leave the faith. So rather than this being an esoteric theological discussion, the author of the book of Hebrews is in a battle for the souls of the people that he's writing to, trying to convince them of the truth and the importance of the truth of the gospel concerning Jesus. Let me just give you a couple of excerpts from the book to show you what I'm talking about. How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? Take care, brethren, lest there should be an evil, unbelieving heart in falling away from the living God. Let us run the race with perseverance, fixing our eyes upon Jesus. How much severer punishment do you think he will deserve who has trampled underfoot the Son of God and has regarded as unclean the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has insulted the Spirit of grace? See to it that you do not refuse him who is speaking. That's the language that we find running through the book. This is not an academic exercise in theology. He is telling them who Jesus is and what he did to remind them what is at stake if they refuse him. Okay. Now, before we go into the first part of Hebrews, into chapter 1, and talk about what we find there, I do need to make the comment, we have a limited amount of time, and I have a limited amount of understanding. The book of Hebrews is filled with some very, very complicated questions, and there are some very complicated questions in the first chapter, and I'm not going to talk about all of them. In fact, some of them, if I were to take them on, that's all we would have time to talk about, and at the end, I don't know where we would be. So what I want to try to do is give you kind of an overview of what's happening here, and at the time for questions at the end, I would really welcome anyone wanting to explore some of the details in the passage. But before we look at the passage itself, I want to just really briefly give you a little background that's going to be helpful as we go into the book. You already, last week, I understand, talked about 2 Samuel 7, sometimes referred to as the Davidic Covenant, the passage where Nathan the prophet comes to David and tells him that his throne is going to be an eternal one. Specifically, telling him that unlike what happened to Saul, the king before him, that the throne of David is not going to be taken away. His descendants will continue to rule. And as I'm sure David talked with you about last week, ultimately, in one way or another, we see in the Davidic covenant a description of what the role and function of Jesus as the Messiah, as the Christ, is all about. He is ultimately the fulfillment of those promises. He is the one who is going to rule over the throne, sit on the throne of David forever. Now, one of the important passages or phrases in 2 Samuel 7 I just wanted to remind you of, because it's going to be crucial as we look at our passage today. He says, speaking about, and I'm sure I understand you had a discussion about this last week, we won't go into it again, but either talking specifically about Jesus or talking about Solomon as the first representative of all of the kings of Israel culminating in Jesus, you can look at it either way. He says, I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men, but my loving kindness shall not depart from him as I took it away from Saul. So the description that God gives through Nathan of the relationship that he is going to have with this person who is going to be sitting on the throne of David is the relationship of father to son. I will be his father and he will be my son. And I would argue that the language of sonship here is, especially in this culture, they would have been very aware that the son is the one who has the authority, who inherits all that belongs to the father. I mean, you can kind of picture the scenario in a household where the servants may be scurrying around doing this or that, but when the son of the household comes along, all of a sudden everybody snaps too. Now here's somebody you have to deal with, the son. The king of Israel, the one sitting on that throne, has the relationship of being like a son to God as his father, implying authority and an inheritance in the things of God. All right. Similarly, I believe that David, after having heard this statement and marveling over what it is that God tells him, wrote a psalm where he is reflecting on and talking about the place of the one who sits on the throne of Israel, the importance of that place in the light of this language that he learned in the Davidic covenant about God being the father and the king being the son. And let me just read this psalm to you really quickly. It's short. Why are the nations in an uproar? Psalm 2, by the way, if I didn't say that. Why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed one. And interestingly, that word there, his anointed one, is the Hebrew word Mashiach, which ultimately we come to know as Messiah. This is the anointed one, the anointed king. And so these kings say, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. So here are the nations in turmoil and not wanting to submit to the rule of God and the rule of his anointed one. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he will speak to them in his anger and terrify them in his fury. And what he says is, but as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. So God laughs at the machinations of the kingdoms around, and he says, I have established my king on Mount Zion. Now, we hear another voice now, the voice of that king himself, I think. He says, I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. So here is the king that God has established on his holy mountain saying, I'm telling of the decree that God has made. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. And what does that mean? Today I have begotten you. Well, I think it's best understood if we remember what this sonship was all about. Who is it that is the son in relationship to God, as we saw in the Davidic covenant? It is the one who comes after David, the one who sits on the throne, this throne that is going to be eternal. I would argue that it is Solomon and the king after him and the king after him, and ultimately none of them were really able to fulfill the role, and Jesus finally comes along to sit on that throne and fulfill and make that throne what it was intended to be. So, as many scholars have argued about Psalm 2, I believe it is a coronation psalm. This is a psalm intended to be read at the coronation of the new king of Israel. I believe David wrote this psalm for the coronation of Solomon, and it was read there. So when he says, you are my son, today I have begotten you, how has he become begotten? How has he been born as his son? He's not talking about his birth. He's already been born for some time. He has been begotten by becoming the king. He has entered into this relationship where now he stands as the son in relationship to God. So, just as it said in the Davidic covenant, the one who sits on the throne of David stands in this relationship of being like a son to God. And implying, as I say it, and as we see in the psalm, it implies authority. God saying to the nations, this is my son. You don't mess with him. This is not just any old guy that I put in a temporary job to rule for a while. This is my son. You don't come along and tell him you don't want him to rule. He's ruling with my say-so. This is my kid, so don't mess with him. That's what that picture implies. Finally, I want to take you to one more psalm. Psalm 89, a sad, sad psalm. This psalm was written after the Babylonians have come along. They have captured those who were in Judea, in Jerusalem, taken them off into captivity. The throne of David has been thrown down. It is gone. There is no king sitting on the throne of David anymore. And so Psalm 89 starts out. First of all, it testifies to the loving kindness of God, how he has made a covenant with David, and God keeps his word. God is a God who has power. He does what he says he's going to do. He reminds us that, in verse 25, okay, starting in 20, he talks about how I have found, this is God speaking, I have found David my servant, With my holy oil I have anointed him, with whom my hand will be established. The psalmist here is thinking back on how God had chosen David to be the special person who was going to establish this throne, this eternal throne. And as the psalm goes on, he reminds us of what God had promised. He goes back to the Davidic covenant and says, this is what God had said he was going to do. And my faithfulness and my loving kindness will be with him, this David that he's talking about. I shall, and in my name his horn shall be exalted. I shall set his hand on the sea and his right hand on the rivers. He will cry to me, you are my Father, my God, and the rock of my salvation. I also shall make him my firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. And there again, we see a very clear picture of how this father-son relationship indicates the authority, the kingship of the son. Notice what he says, I shall make him my firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. Just like the firstborn son in the family is the one with the authority and prestige, so this one who is descended from David, or those who are descended from David, have this unique relationship where they are like God's firstborn, a higher position than any other king on the earth. And then he goes along to say, if his sons forsake my law and do not walk in my judgments, if they violate my statutes and do not keep my commandments, then I will visit their transgression with the rod and their iniquity with stripes, but I will not break off my loving kindness from him. And so the psalm recounts how God has promised that the throne of David will be eternal, and he will be with it, and he will establish David's descendants forever. The psalm ends then with this plaintive cry, God, what are you doing? But you have cast off and rejected. You have been full of wrath against your anointed one. And he's talking about the Babylonian captivity. The throne that you promised that was going to last forever is gone. What's happening? How are you going to keep your promise to us? And in one of the great cries that the people of God have been calling out throughout the ages, I think, in verse 46 he says, how long, O Lord, will you hide yourself forever? So a very plaintive, mournful, evocative psalm. But what's striking in it, I hope, is that we see once again that he's referring back to this promise that God had made in the Davidic covenant and saying that there is an eternal throne with descendants of David sitting on it, and the one sitting on the throne is in this relationship with God like a son, like the firstborn, like the highest in the household, because he is the firstborn son of the master of the household. That's the relationship that the king of Israel has to God and to the rest of the world. You and I come to the king sitting on that throne as people who are not even members of the family, coming to the one who is the son, the one who has the authority and prestige. As the Old Testament goes along then, after the things that we've read here, the prophets start to tell more and more specifically about how one person is going to come along to fulfill these promises. It was never God's intention for one king to sit on the throne and then for him to have a kid and there's another king and then another king and then another king. The eternal throne of David is going to be eternal because one person is going to come along and sit on that throne eternally. That's how that promise is going to be fulfilled. In other words, the prophets essentially come along and answer the question that Psalm 89 has raised. What are you doing, God? How long is this going to be? The prophets say, there is a descendant of David coming. And when he comes, he is going to sit on that throne and he is going to establish righteousness and peace on the earth and so on. That's the person that we come to refer to as the Messiah. He's called the Messiah because the word Mashiach means anointed. He is the anointed one, the one who has been anointed by God to rule. We refer to him as the Christ because That's the Greek word that means anointed. So it's the Greek version of the Hebrew Messiah. But there's another name that came to be used by the time we get to the time of the New Testament for this Messiah, this Christ, this King that they were waiting for to come. And that was, they were waiting for the Son. The one who was in this relationship with God, where he was like God's Son, ruling over the world with the authority of his Father. Now, having said all that, we open up the book of Hebrews and find this. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son. The book of Hebrews starts out talking about Jesus as the Son. When he speaks of him as the Son, he's referring to this expectation that had arisen from the Old Testament, that there was one coming who would sit on the throne of David, who would rule forever, and who would be in this relationship of Father and Son with God. As we're going to see in a minute, he quotes some of the very passages that we were just looking at. What does he say here? God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets, in many portions and in many ways. He's picturing here, God has been telling us what's going on through the prophets, but he's been doing it piecemeal. He gives a vision to a prophet over here. He tells this other prophet a little bit more about what it is that he's planning to do. He made promises to Abraham, but those promises are very general and a little vague as to what's going on. God has been sort of sprinkling history with little bits and pieces of revelation about his purposes. But now, in these last days, he has spoken to us in his Son. The first point that the author of Hebrews is trying to make to his readers who are thinking about giving up on Jesus is Jesus is this Son. He is the one through whom God has declared finally and completely what his purposes are for history. In the coming of Jesus, in his life, in his ministry, in the message that he proclaimed, and then the message that his apostles proclaimed after him, we have God's big final word on what it is he's doing. So, who are you Hebrews thinking of walking away from? You're walking away from one who is, first of all, the greatest prophet that we have ever seen, because he has given a more complete picture of what God is about than anyone else in the entire history of the Old Testament. Who are you going to go back to in the Old Testament that's better than Jesus? Because he is the complete story. He's finally made it clear to us what God is about and what he's doing. Now, he says a number of things then about this Son. And remember, this is a very pregnant phrase, the Son. This is that one who comes to rule, whom he appointed heir of all things. Everything belongs to Jesus. He is that King. He is that one who inherits everything that belongs to the Father because he's the Son. He inherits us. If you look at the picture, ultimately, that the Bible paints as King of all the universe, part of his inheritance is having a set of subjects, a set of people who see him for what he is, who appreciate and love him because he has rescued them from destruction. We're all a part of the all things that he is heir to. He says, through whom also he made the world. And you will now see me punt because I have nothing to say about that phrase. I can tell you what Jack says about it. I can tell you that I'm not convinced yet. And beyond that, I have nothing to say. If you want to talk about it during the question time, I'll be glad to do it. Something very important is being said there. And I don't know what it is. Okay, now, we come to this section here. This one, we're talking about the Son, who, being the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, And the idea here, this is something that you see in several places in the New Testament and is a very, very important idea, that in Jesus, in the man Jesus, you look at him who is the Son, and what you see is somehow the character, the essence of God himself. In fact, I use that word character. This the exact representation there comes from a Greek word that we get our word character from, and it's kind of like saying you see the stamp of God upon him. It's like the God's image has been put upon him. The invisible God, the God that we cannot see, who is transcendent and beyond this creation, you see him stamped upon Jesus. That's what he's saying, essentially. Now, I think I have just a minute to make an exegetical example here. Just a little thing that I might call to your attention. I think this is interesting. We have this phrase here, and upholding all things by the word of his power. I've always read that as saying, okay, well, upholding all things by the word of his power. Somehow Jesus spends, in some way, spends his time holding up creation and making it work. That somehow through the word of his power, Jesus the Son is holding everything together and making the whole creation work. I suppose that's possible. But what I want to point out is, if we want to come along and try to understand what the author of Hebrews is saying, we need to think about this a little bit. There's an interesting pattern, I think, that I would point out to you as something that we'd want to consider as we try to figure out what this is saying. Notice how we have here, we start out talking about God. God is the one who's acting here. He spoke to the prophets before, and now he's spoken to us in his Son. And then in each of these phrases, we have two parties. We have God and the Son being pictured. He, God, appointed him, Jesus, the Son, heir of all things, through whom he, God, made the world. Now, we don't know what this means yet, but I would argue that there are two parties here, God and the Son, that are being talked about. The Son is the radiance of his, God's, glory, and the character, the exact representation of his, God's, nature. As we follow this through, the natural way to take this pattern would be to say, and upholding all things by the word of his, God's, power. So, I'm very much inclined to understand this phrase in a slightly different way than it sounds at first. That this is a series of the radiance of his glory, the representation of his nature, the word of his power, that there's a pattern that's falling through there, and we're talking about God in all three of them. What about upholding? Well, that upholding is not a very good translation. Upholding is something that the translators decided on here because they couldn't figure out what to do with it, and they thought maybe that might work. But the word is bearing, the word that is we sometimes translate as bearing. And what you find in the New Testament when you see this word being used is that there are several senses that this word has, but there are two very common ones. There's bearing in the sense of bringing, and you translate it bringing. You know, and you can go and find dozens of places in the New Testament where this word is just translated, you know, he brought this, and he brought this to this person, and he brought this to this person. He bore it to them, and you know, the idea is he carried it and he brought it over to him. And the other way that the word is sometimes used is to talk about bearing in the sense of bearing a burden. I'm bearing, you know, I'm under the weight of a heavy load, of some sort of burden. So, I think that whatever we do with this phrase, see, this is why this is just my little exegetical comment. I'm still working on how to understand it, but I would say that what we ought to do with this is something like the Son is the one who is the radiance of God's glory, the exact representation of God's nature, and the one who either bears the burden of all things, with respect to the word of God's power, or with respect to his powerful word, or something like that, or else the one who brings all things with respect to his power, with respect to God's powerful word. Jack has argued in this passage, I think, if I remember, that it's something like Jesus brings all things which are in accordance with God's word. That is, he is the one who brings about all of the things that are in keeping with the promises that God has made, or something like that. Isn't that right, Jack? Well, I'm not exactly sure whether that's the way to take it, but I can see very easily why Jack would want to go in that direction, because that fits the pattern through here very well, and is closer to the meaning of what the way the word bearing is used typically than the other way of taking it. So the main reason I wanted to point that out to you, it's a little side road, I know, because I'm not quite sure myself how to put it together here, but it just seemed to me like a really nice little example of how if you just pay a little bit of attention to the way things are being put together, you can see that there are interpretive issues here that run a little deeper sometimes than the translators are showing you. Okay, end of my little exegetical detour. Back to the question of the Son and who he is and what he's about. He comes to the end here saying, having made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. So, right there, we've got two important ideas. The book of Hebrews is going to talk about Jesus as the perfect high priest, the one who himself offers himself as the sacrifice to make propitiation for our sins, and is himself also the priest who makes that offering to God. A crucially important part of the picture of who Jesus is as the Son is that he makes this offering, the offering that nobody else could make, and if he didn't make it, we would be sunk. I mean, that's a crucial part of the argument in Hebrews when he's telling them, you're worried about Jesus? You think somehow he's not impressive enough? I mean, this is the one. If he has not made the offering for your sins, you're cooked, because there you can slaughter a million animals, doves and pigeons and oxen, and you bring them in. It's not going to work. It's not going to solve the problem. He is the one who has made the purification of sins that's really going to deal with the problem the way it needs to be dealt with. And after he did that, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. And we need to understand that picture of being at the right hand of the Majesty on high is the place of authority. That's another image of his kingship, of his right to rule, sitting at the right hand of God. We have that phrase, you know, someone, he's my right-hand man, meaning he is the person close to me, the one that I rely on, the one if he comes to you and says, you know, the boss needs this, he's speaking for me, so you'd better give it to him, because he's my right-hand man. Well, that's what Jesus is. He is at the right hand of the Majesty on high. In this section, as we've come along here, we have seen evidence of, you may have heard before, there's a very popular sort of phrase to speak of Jesus in his roles as saying he is prophet, priest, and king. Well, we see all of that in Hebrews 1 here. He is the one who brings that final message from God. He is the prophet above all prophets who has spoken the word that really tells us what God is all about. He's a priest. He has made the purification of sins, the only purification of sins that's going to work. And he's the king. He is the Son. He is the one who rules with the authority of God, who is sitting at the right hand of God. So this very exalted picture that he paints of Jesus is intended to speak to them about their concerns about somehow Jesus being inadequate, that they've decided somehow maybe that Jesus is not the Messiah. They have a problem with him as the Messiah. Now, notice the last thing he says in this sentence. This is all one sentence, basically, in the beginning of Hebrews. He says, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, having become as much better than the angels as he has inherited a more excellent name than they. Now, there's two things that we ought to look at here. First of all, what's he saying? How is he better than the angels? He's asking the question, how much more better than the angels has he become, sitting at the right hand of God? He made purification of sins. He's sitting at the right hand of God. How much better than the angels has he become? Well, I'll tell you, he's become as much better than the angels as his name is better than theirs. That's how much better he is. What's his name? Son. What's their name? Angels. Well, angels is our English anglicized version of the Greek word angelos, which means messenger. The word angel, really, it's misleading to us. Both in Hebrew and in Greek, they didn't have a word angel. They had just the common word messenger. And these angels that are sent around by God are messengers from God. So the messenger of the Lord is the angel of the Lord. And so a messenger appeared to them. That's the way they were using the language. And they understood that these messengers were messengers from God. So the point that he's making here, which is a point that we're going to see explored here for a little bit in Hebrews, is his name is better than theirs. Being the Son is a lot bigger deal than being a messenger. A messenger is like, you know, a flunky. It's like, hey, come here, go tell him this. That's not the way you deal with the Son. The Son is unique. The Son has a unique place at the right hand of the Majesty on high. That's what he's saying here. His name is better than theirs. But why is he saying that? I mean, that's the question that you and I come to when we come to a passage like this, because, I don't know, did it ever occur to you to think that the angels were better than Jesus? I mean, having 2,000 years of Christian history behind us, this is not an idea that has been promulgated much. I mean, that's not the way people have been thinking. But I think what we have to recognize is it's very much what the people at the time that he's writing here were wrestling with. And the problem, I think, is something like this. And Jack has really helped me to see this. We've had an opportunity, gosh, we've gone through Hebrews 2 or 3 times, I think. And as you go and you look through the whole book, it becomes real clear what's going on here, I think. The people that he's writing to are having a problem with Jesus on a couple of fronts. They have a problem with Jesus because he's a human being. And we see this through the next several chapters of the book. His main concern is to defend the idea that it's okay that Jesus is a human being. In fact, not only is it okay, it's essential. He had to be a human being in order to do what needed to be done. But why is he saying that? Why is he so intent on defending the fact that Jesus is a human being? It's because it bothered these Jews who are starting to think about this and going, you're telling me that this guy, I mean, the story is, right? He came to the earth, he was born, he lived, I mean, he went along, he got dirty, you know, he got hungry, he suffered, and then they hung him on a cross, and he's like blood hanging all over him, and he died. This is the Messiah? This is the Christ? This is the Son of God that you're telling me about here? Our expectation was somehow that he was going to be somebody more impressive. Like maybe like the angels, you know? There's a certain amount of evidence in the literature before the time of the New Testament that they had a conception of the Messiah as being almost like a superhuman angelic being. I mean, they would have expected someone to come upon the scene, you know, who was, you know, twice as tall as anyone else and glowing and, you know, sweeping armies aside with his fist and, you know, this kind of thing. And it was just, he's a carpenter and he died. That's the problem that they have. It makes a whole lot of sense that that's the problem that they had, because that's exactly the problem that the author of Hebrews tries to deal with as he goes through the letter. So his point here is a very, very important one. What he's saying is, if we kind of put it together then, look, yeah, okay, the angels, impressive. I mean, you know, they show up, you know, glowing and all kinds of weird things are happening. Superhuman beings, right? Different than you and me. Supernatural beings. Great. But when it comes right down to it, who's the Son? Jesus, the man, the human being who died. He's the Son. They're the messengers. So who's better? Who's more important? Who's more significant? It's the Son who is significant, and the messengers are just messengers. That's his point. At this point, then, he goes to quote a series of passages from the Old Testament, which we're not going to look at all of them because there's a lot involved. But we can, right off the bat, we can understand what he says as soon as we get it down where we can see it. For to which of the angels did he ever say, "You are my son, today I have begotten you, and again I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me"? This is a quote from Psalm 2, which we looked at, the coronation psalm. The language that says, the king, the one who is sitting on Mount Zion, established there by God, God calls him my son. And on the day he becomes king, he says, "I have begotten you." And again, "I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me." That's from 2 Samuel 7, which you looked at last week, the Davidic covenant. It doesn't really matter in the end whether we see both of these as talking specifically about Jesus or whether it's talking about the throne of David with all of the various kings that are sitting on that throne. Because in the end, it all comes down to the same thing. The promises become clear in the end that there is only one who can fulfill those promises. David couldn't fulfill them. Solomon couldn't fulfill them. There is one coming who can fulfill them, and Jesus is that one. To which of the angels did he ever say that? "You are my son. I have established you as king, and you are like my son in relationship to the world. Everyone has to listen to you as being my son." Which of the angels did he ever say that to? None of them. On the contrary, we might look at this one here, of the angels he says, "God, who makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire," that's from the New American Standard. I don't know why in the world they translated it this way. It makes no sense. It's obviously not what the Old Testament passage is saying. It's saying, God is the one who makes the winds his messengers, is what it says, and who makes a flame of fire his ministers. But it's a picture of God who can call up the wind and say, "Wind, I want you to be my messenger. Go do this." Well, you can see the contrast is between, as he's going to go on to talk about here, this throne that God sets up is forever and ever, an eternal throne that the Son is going to sit on, as compared to the angels, the messengers, who, heck, God could take some fire and make it his messenger. He could take some wind and make it his messenger. The Son is sitting on a throne that God has promised will be eternal. This throne will be established, and it will not be put down. It will not fail. It will not fade. That's the difference between the angels, the messengers, and the Son. So there are a lot of interesting technical questions that we could talk about with each of these passages as to what exactly they're saying and how exactly he's using them. But the general point is a very clear one. What he's trying to say here is, on the one hand, we have the messengers who are temporal, they're servants, they're those who have been called to serve the Son, and as we see down here, even to serve humanity. They are servants. The Son is the Son. He rules the throne established by God. So what he's doing here is pointing to the Old Testament and saying, you know, this Old Testament that you want to go back to has told you how you ought to look at this. The angels are just messengers. Yes, they're supernaturally flashy, but they're just messengers. The Son rules with the authority of God. He is the one that you can't, you know, if there's anybody that you can safely ignore, you can't really safely ignore an angel, as we're going to see in a minute, but you'd be much better off ignoring an angel than you would be ignoring the Son. Because the Son is the Son. He's the one that has all of the authority, all of the rights in this. So, this rather well-known section of passages that he quotes, he's quoting it to remind them that the Old Testament itself has given them the picture of how this works. For them to think that somehow an angelic being would be superior to the Son makes no sense at all. And then he concludes this section, I would say, he wraps it up by asking, what should you do then? How should you respond to this? And then he answers it. For this reason, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. For what reason? Because of everything he has just said. Because of everything he said about who Jesus is and his authority and what it means that he is the Son. For all of that, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. Rather than thinking, somehow I'm not impressed with this Jesus because he's not like an angel, I had better start listening carefully to what it is he had to say. For, if the words spoken through angels proved unalterable, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? He's saying, go back and look at the Old Testament. If an angel comes along and says something and somebody disregards it, you're in big trouble. So if you're in big trouble for disregarding what the angels said, how much more trouble are you going to be in if you disregard what the Son of God has said? How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? And you can see that he's emphasizing here what the Son has said. He has pronounced this great salvation. He has pronounced that our sins can be forgiven, that he has paid the price to make it possible for us to be rescued from this world and the destruction that's coming upon it. That's a great salvation. If I look at that message and say, no, I don't really think that's interesting, I'll go back to offering sheep and goats and doves and stuff at the temple, though, that'll be okay. He says, how are you going to escape if you turn away from the main message? Here God comes along and his Son says, this is what it's been all about. And you look at it and you say, well, no, I don't really like that, but, you know, boy, I'm really into that temple stuff. Let's go back and do some of that. That's not going to get you anywhere. You've turned away from the main event, so you're not going to find anything out in the side roads that are going to get you anywhere. You turned away from the great salvation itself. He says, after it was first spoken through the Lord, it was confirmed to us by those who heard. Now you can tell there, when he says spoken through the Lord, by the Lord he means Jesus. He's talking about now, thinking back to the time when Jesus was on earth, when he proclaimed his message. After it was at first spoken through the Lord, it was confirmed to us by those who heard. The apostles, Peter and John, and so on, coming along and telling us what it is that Jesus said, confirming that indeed that is what he said. And then he says, God also bearing witness with them, both by signs and wonders and by various miracles and by gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his own will. And I just point out that to me this is a very, very important passage if we try to sort out what it is the Bible has to say about gifts of the Spirit and signs and wonders and all of that kind of stuff. Because this passage here is telling us what their purpose was. Why did God do those signs and wonders and miracles and gifts? They were to testify, to bear witness with the apostles that what they were saying is true. So he's saying that the miracles that the apostles did, the miracles that Jesus did, were intended to be a message from God saying, yes, I too am saying along with them, this indeed is what it's about. This is what Jesus said, this is what's true, this is what you ought to believe. It may seem at first, when we read a section like this, that we have some fairly abstract sort of discussions about the Old Testament and angels and this kind of stuff, but I hope I've been able to get across to you a little bit what's at stake as the author of Hebrews is writing this. This is the opening shot in his battle for their souls. He's saying, you're complaining because Jesus is not as impressive as the angels? Somehow you're let down by this? You're not thinking this is an impressive enough person to be the Messiah? This human being that you're ready to turn away from has brought us the final word on the purposes of God. All of creation belongs to Him. When we look at Him, we see the very essence of God Himself, His character, His nature. When we look at Jesus, we see the one who made the priestly offering which rescues us from our sin. We see the one who is the King, who sits at the right hand of God and rules over all creation with the authority of God Himself. So you cannot walk away from Him and expect to go back to your Old Testament religion. This is the supreme person in all of history, and He is what the Old Testament religion was all about. That's essentially what He's done in His opening shot here in the beginning of Hebrews. As we go on in the book, you find Him talking about strange things like the priesthood, which is according to the priesthood of Melchizedek, and all kinds of things which seem strange when you look at them. But when you go and look a little bit, you'll see what He's doing is He's just trying to go back to the Old Testament and make a case for various aspects of Jesus as the Messiah. The Old Testament said that Jesus was going to be the kind of Messiah that He turned out to be, He says. Go back and look. The Old Testament gives us a picture of what being a person of faith looks like. Go back and look. It tells you what we need to do. We need to persevere in faith. And now here's the supreme message that I need to believe and hold on to and persevere in my faith. That's what the book is doing. So as I said, really, in essence, although it's heavily theological in some sense, it's essentially an evangelistic book. It is setting out to call them back from the foolishness of having unreal expectations about what Jesus should have been and then turning away from Him because He didn't meet those expectations. Okay, so a pretty big and profound picture of who Jesus is and what He means to us. Let's stop here. Anybody who wants to leave can go, and then there won't be a break. We'll just pick right up with questions, but if start up again. Okay, so any questions or comments?
We're just saying that the expectations that the Jews had for what their Messiah would be like was unrealistic. But it seems like if they just took what was in the promise of face value, that the king would reign forever, and everything would be, his terrain and from the sea to everywhere, then they might look at that and say, well, that's the qualifications for a Messiah. This person doesn't meet those qualifications. Therefore.
Well, right, that's a good question. I think my answer to that would be that, and I think the author of Hebrews brings this out as well, that it's not that that Jesus is not obviously in very significant ways a supernatural being. I mean, the story is that He rose from the dead and death will never take Him again. So He's the forerunner. He is the first of all of humanity who has escaped death and entered into eternal life. So the story about Jesus is, it is a human being, He is a human being who rose from the dead and thus indeed can sit on this eternal throne forever that rules over everything because He lives eternally. So I think the problem that they're having is not, yes, you're right. I mean, one, you could speculate and say, okay, well, yeah, we're going to need somebody special, obviously, to fulfill the role that's being asked for here. But the problem is when Jesus shows up and he's not special in the way they wanted him to be special. And I'm inclined to think that part of the problem they're having with it is when we look